You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to the final offscript of 2015. This is American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here with...
Susie Evans, I'm the Senior Editor.
Allison Considine, the editorial assistant.
And Deep Tran, associate editor.
And we're going to look back over the year, 2015, the year of Hamilton, officially, some highlights, and then talk about the things that we liked the most on stage, basically. And then we have an interview with Mary Zimmerman, who this year staged Guys and Dolls at Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and right now has a production of Treasure Island at Looking Glass. So we had a nice Skype conversation with Mary. And then we'll come back and offer our wishes and what we're looking forward to in 2016. Our January issue, looking ahead really briefly, is a special training issue, and we're going to have that up by the time this podcast is up. We're going to have the training articles in which we focused on acting training and particularly on what we call the mind-body divide. Not to get too much into that, but essentially we've noticed that actors – have to train their minds as well as their bodies, and often they're trained separately with physical theater on the one hand and then scene study on the other. We tried to do some interesting stories about how those things are separate or brought together. The idea was suggested, frankly, by the Wilma Theater's upcoming Tom Stoppard premiere, The Hard Problem, which is about the mind-body divide. And it actually was an interesting way to think of the Wilma Theater's work, which has been sort of cerebral and political and heady, as well as visceral and movement based. So look for that. A big profile, Blanca Ziska at the Wilma, is also a big feature of our January issue. But first, let's look back at the year. This was not only the year of Hamilton. It opened at the public in January and then transferred to Broadway in July and will run forever. And we'll probably sweep the Tonys and the Pulitzer next year, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. There's really no question about that. It was also the year I didn't realize until I looked back of the LA 99 seat controversy. It was all this year. Some of it was teased last year, but this is the year that Equity tried to crack down on 99 seat plays in Los Angeles. And that was particularly dear to my heart. That was a scene that I cut my teeth on, that I got the theater bug on. And so I covered that. It seems to be ending the year with some kind of resolution where, plaintiffs, Equity members, including Ed Asner and some others, had sued their union over the changes they tried to make, and they now seem to be negotiating and talking. So it's been de-escalated, the conflict, and hopefully something good will come out of this. Let's see what else. We all there were a number of casting controversies that we highlighted this more this fall. Deep wrote about that a lot, and basically we can just set the Mikado. Jesus in India.
Cry Trojans.
Yeah, that was earlier this year.
Mountaintop.
Yeah. It seems to be a hot issue. And we also have our most recent salvo in that front is our executive director, Teresa Eyring, who wrote a letter and got a lot of signatures summed up as in favor of playwrights' rights regarding casting and against quote unquote colorblind casting, against.
And well, it was also about color conscious casting instead of colorblind casting, and not ignoring race and taking into account the inequities in the field when you're casting a role.
Exactly. That was a hot topic this year. This was also a year we had a great conference in Cleveland, and we had a lot of staff turnover. Eliza Bent, one of our beloved senior editors, moved on and now freelances for us a lot. And there was some reshuffling, and Susie became a senior editor, and we added Allison Considine as our editorial assistant. Russ Denman came in as a production editor, and at the top, Jim O'Quinn, who founded the magazine in 1984, departed for a wonderful retirement in New Orleans, and I took the reins of this bucking bronco here, and we're... Things are going well, I would say, if people ask me. Let's talk about the travels we made this year. My big one was going to Ashland to go to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, one of my favorite places, and talk to one of my favorite people, I think I can say, Bill Rausch, about what he's doing there. It hasn't been all smooth sailing. It hasn't been a utopia, but he's definitely idealistic. and they're doing great things there. Susie, where'd you go this year, and what'd you see?
I saw a lot. I went to Chicago, I think, 3 times this year, maybe 2 times. I have family in Chicago, so they weren't all work-related, but I definitely saw some theater while I was out there. I saw a lot. I saw a great review at Second City. I saw Hypocrites, Summer Hill Hypocrites, Gilbert and Sullivan. Maybe that was last year. I feel like it was this year. It's all blur. I saw Carousel, the Lyric Opera. I saw a lot of good stuff and some other things I'll name in my favorites of the year. I went to the Williamstown Theater Festival and saw the new William Inge play that got uncovered and world premiered at Williamstown. The title's escaping me now, but Kira Sedgwick was in it. On the Road or something like that. Anyway, and then I also went to D.C. for, we did a big cover on the Women's Voices Festival, and so I did some interviews and a photo shoot while I was there, and also got to see a show, which I will mention later.
Great. And Allison, you came in April and just got right off traveling right away to Contemporary American Theater Festival, right?
I did. And well, right before that was Cleveland. So I hopped on board and started prepping for our Cleveland conference, which was exciting. And then I headed off to West Virginia to the Contemporary American Theater Festival, and I saw 5 brand new plays, which was pretty neat, at Shepherd University there. And then I, too, went to Chicago. It was my first time to Chicago, which is pretty exciting. I went to Steppenwolf and saw East of Eden, and I, too, visited the Hypocrites and saw a review at Second City. It was a whirlwind weekend where I got to visit all the greats, so it was good. And the Goodman. Went to the Goodman.
We definitely try to, cover the whole country as best we can. We don't have a huge travel budget. I remember now I went to Chicago as well, but it was really briefly to interview of Bob Falls and Nathan Lane and Brian Dennehy, who brought Iceman Cummins to BAM. But I didn't have time to see any shows, I don't think, while I was there. Deep, where'd you go this year? SoCal?
Too many places. Because if you give me money to travel, I'm going to take advantage of it.
All right.
So this year I went to the Humana Festival, which brought me back full circle, because that's why I did my first year here when I was Allison as an editorial assistant.
All right.
And then after that, I went to the Pacific Playwrights Festival at South Coast Repertory Theater in Costa Mesa, California.
That's right. You did a great coverage of both of those, new play
films. Yes. Yeah. So many new plays. Yeah, went to a conference in Cleveland, got drunk with Paula Vogel, and then I went to the Without Walls Festival at La Jolla Playhouse in California, too, and saw a lot of site-specific outdoor work. I saw theaters in cars, I saw theaters in proscenium, all of the things.
Nice. Nice. So we did try to get out and about. I believe Russ Denbin, our production editor, is not here at the moment. He went to Austin at least once and caught some stuff there, which is where he went to graduate school. So we did try to cover as much as we can. We mainly rely, of course, on our wonderful stable of freelancers and correspondents around the country. Now let's look at, I think that covers everything that happened this year, right? We are also theater goers and, self-styled theater critics. We like things. We don't like things. Let's talk about what are some of our favorite things on stage this year, wherever we happen to see them. Let's start with you, Susie, since you're right there.
Sure. I think I've said on this podcast many times, and I'm kind of becoming notorious for it, that I really love a good living room drama. Like, give me a good living room drama. And one of my favorite plays I saw this year was a great living room drama, and it was at the Steppenwolf in Chicago. It was called The Herd by British actor-playwright Rory Kinnear. The only actor I remember was in it was Lois Smith, but she was great. And it's basically about a family coming together to celebrate someone in the family's birthday, someone like a sibling. That sibling never appears on stage. I won't say why, but it's important to the plot. And it's just about family dynamics in a gorgeous house, a great set. And it was just a really moving family drama. And I know we have too many of those in American theater, and they can be done well, and they can be done poorly. But The Herd was really, really good. And I hope that it comes to New York or it comes somewhere else, has a bigger life. I think it premiered in England, and then the first American premiere was at Steppenwolf.
And The Herd is H-E-R-D, like the...
Yeah, H-E-R-D.
Stampeding herd, right?
Yeah, like a family, like a herd, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know. That's what I assumed the title meant.
Sure.
There's not like a reference to like a stampede in the show. It's great. It's multi-generational. It deals with a lot of issues. highly recommend it. It's probably a good read too. It's just a good, so if you want to find a copy of it. My other favorite thing that I saw this year, which Deep did some coverage of in the magazine, was the revival of The King and I at Lincoln Center, directed by Bartlett Sher and starring Kelly O'Hara. I just, you know, I love a good old-fashioned musical, and that was just a lushly designed, beautifully sung, gorgeous, worth the price of admission Broadway show. And I, you know, people have qualms with it. Rob is crossing his arms right now.
I'm not judging.
But I just thought it was everything that you wanted from a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical. I mean, Ruthie Ann Miles is amazing in it. Ashley Park is amazing in it. Conrad Rickamore is great in it. I don't know who's playing the king now, but I saw
Coon Lee.
I saw Ken Watanabe and Jose Lana both do it, and they were both great. So yeah, it's still playing. So if you're in New York or coming here, it's really, really wonderful. And you know, not many Broadway shows are worth $200. I would say this one is. Do I do my honorable mention now?
Sure, why not? Why not?
And I guess we're doing an honorable mention, although it's probably, I wouldn't say it's in my favorite of the year, but I was really excited about it, and it's coming to New York in 2016. I saw Dear Evan Hansen at Arena Stage in D.C. I'm a big fan of Justin Paul and Benj Pasek, and their work as composers. This is their first original musical that they've ever written. I mean, they have Dogfight and A Christmas Story, but both are based on movies. It's really personal to them. It's based on something that really happened to them. It deals with social media and teen angst in a way I've never seen theater really deal with. Ben Platt gives amazing performance. So does Rachel Bay Jones. I hope they're both coming to the second stage production, which I think opens in April in New York. But I really liked it. It has some work definitely to be done, but I'm glad it's getting another life and that we'll get to see it again.
Sounds great. Sounds great. Allison, I think you teased us what your favorites are, and they're all out of town. Is that right?
That is true. So at the Contemporary American Theater Festival, I saw Stephen Dietz's the world premiere of his new play, On Clover Road, which was a thriller, and it took place in this desolate motel room between this mother and a private investigator that she hires to find her daughter who has run away. So it's really intense. I'd never seen anything like that on stage. It was neat to have the audience reacted in such a way that they did, with people gasping and yelling, and you know, just the lighting of it was really cool, and the set was there wasn't much to it, but I think that added to the play, this really intense, you didn't know what was gonna happen. And I really like that. And it's coming to San Francisco Playhouse. It'll be there March 23rd, it opens. And the other thing that I really like that stood out from my travels was The Hypocrites production of American Idiot. It was the first time I had seen American Idiot on stage, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I always liked the album, but it was neat to see the stories behind it, and it really came alive in the Den Theater, just that space there. It's just an intimate theater, and they just did a really great job with it. This cast album makes a lot more sense now.
Did they make a cast album of that?
Oh, no. I mean the
original
album.
Concept album. Interesting. The
original concept album. I do have an honorable mention, too.
Yeah,
I saw East of Eden at Steppenwolf, which I went in thinking it was not going to be my cup of tea, but I was surprised. It was John Steinbeck's East of Eden, adapted by Frank Galati. And the set was just amazing. It went by quickly. I was really into the story. It was an enjoyable matinee. Just took all afternoon.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Deep?
Sure. My highlight of the year was Queen Nguyen's Viet Gone. I saw it at South Coast Repertory Theater. It's going to be playing at Oregon Shakespeare Festival next year, starting in March, and then at Manhattan Theater Club in September 2016. It's opening their season.
Nice.
And it was the first time that I ever saw a representation of a Vietnamese family that resembled my own family, and was about the Vietnam War from the perspectives of the South Vietnamese, which my family originally came from. and my dad fought in the war too. And so it was one of those experiences on stage where I thought, oh my God, I can finally see myself on stage and I don't have to pretend that I'm, you know, a Jewish person or a black person. And I thought, oh my God, everyone gets to do, gets to feel this all the time. That's great. And so that, well, that was a highlight of my year. And then my other honorable mentions, we didn't mention Fun Home.
This I was going to say Fun Home and The Humans were going to be
in our sort of
multiple recommendations, but Fun Home certainly on Broadway did a great job. Just recouped.
Well, yeah, and it won the Tony, make it, yes, all the Tonys, all the ladies won Tonys, which was a highlight in Tony history.
So was The Ring of Keys, but yes.
Yes, and The Ring of Keys, and Sydney Lucas, all highlights.
My favorite thing about The Ring of Keys is I went to see Fun Home again this weekend, and I was really lucky to get to see it again, and I love that show, and I went backstage and was chatting with Michael Cerveris afterwards, and he was like, so many people are coming to see our shows and they're like, I saw that little girl sing The Ring of Keys on the Tonys and I didn't know what this show was about, but I just want to see a little girl sing. I didn't think I would like it, but I did. I liked it. So like, I thought it was like, it's like, that was Michael Cerveris is how he relayed the story.
That was his Southern accent.
So middle American. He did a better Southern accent than I did.
Well, because he lives there, doesn't he?
He said the Texas. Middle America is coming to this play about a lesbian coming of age and parental...
And her gay father.
And parental troubles.
And Lea Salonga is going to be in the Filipino version in the Philippines.
Oh, really?
She's going to play the... in Helen.
Mom.
Mom. The
Days and Days.
The Judy Kuhn role. Nice. That's currently being played.
Nice. So
I would like to hear her sing that here in New York City because I cannot afford to fly to the Philippines. Bootleg it, somebody, please.
Do you have an honorable mention?
I do have an honorable mention. Taylor Mack! All of the Taylor Macks. Because this year I saw 3 Taylor Mack shows. I saw his 24-decade history of popular music at the Under the Radar Festival in January. It was from the 1900s to the 1950s. It was 6 hours total. No bathroom break, and I saw in 3-hour installments, but I sat there the entire time. And I did not care that it was 3 hours long. I wanted it to be longer. And then he's currently doing another version, other decades, because it's going to be a 24-hour performance event in 2016. But he's currently doing 3 other decades in Seattle right now, I think.
Okay.
So he's doing some in San Francisco in January. January 21st, the 26th, I think.
Yeah. So if Taylor Mack comes to your town, go see him because it's going to be so much fun. He's going to look gorgeous and it will be an event that you won't forget. And also if his play, here, H.I.R. comes to your town, you should go see that too. It is a living room drama that I actually enjoy because unlike Susie, I do not enjoy living room dramas.
This is a conversation for another time.
But why did you like it real briefly?
Because it portrayed a rare woman that not behaving badly, but not caring about being a typical wife and mother and flawed women. We don't see very many flawed women in pop culture or in plays, really. They're usually relegated to, in living room dramas, to being a mom and, you know, taking care of people and things like that. And to see Christine Nielsen, you know, finding her own voice and talking about, you know, genderqueer identities was really refreshing.
It's funny that play needs to be subtitled HIR because everyone goes here, HIR. When I went to go get tickets, the person at the box office said, tickets for here, HIR, because if you just say here, people are like, here, where? Yeah, so anyway.
It's like a Who's on First sketch.
We have a visitor today. Russ Denben is here. Russ, do you have a couple shows that you particularly liked in the 2015? Why don't you tell us about them?
Yes, absolutely. I have a feeling one was mentioned before, but sadly I was in a meeting, so I do not know I'm repeating it. That's that's Futurity.
No, it has not been mentioned.
So no kidding. Awesome. All right, so I'll be the first one to mention Futurity. And the other show from this year, not technically created this year, but I saw it this year, so it counts for me, was Now, Now, Oh Now in Austin, Texas by Rude Mex. And they come around very often, so with luck, they'll be coming to a town near you very soon.
Why did you like them?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about both
you
shows.
You bet. So Futurity The first reason I'm going to list might sound a little offbeat, which is that it doesn't stick to the rules. Like, if you go buy the book about lyric writing according to Finishing the Hat by Stephen Sondheim, it does not pass muster. But because it works so well with the band aesthetic, with the offbeat nature of the show in general, it just works as a whole so well that it just comes across beautifully. And the whole idea, I know Rob's written a lot about it, but the whole idea of a band musical is really exciting. Yeah. And the way that that piece is staged really preserves the idea of a concert and the fun and liveliness of a concert that a lot of musicals don't have. So, for instance, you could see that show any number of times and it'll be different every time, at least because of the patter that you get between the different band members of the Lisps.
Yeah, yeah.
And Now, Oh Now, I'd never seen Rude Max do anything immersive before. It's a very intimate show. It's only 30 people per performance. And, the first act is very passive. So it's kind of like an environmental staging of the presentation of an RPG game. I forget the term for live. It's LARP. That's it. They're LARPing. In the first act.
Live action role playing.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Live action role playing in the first act. So you have a game master who introduces you to the game and then brings you into the room and you get to encounter it. You witness them playing the game. The second act, you're given instructions about how to play the game. So it's actually just the audience on their own with a little bit of guidance from the game master, who's the stand-in for the dungeon master in this case, because it's a little bit like D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, and, which I've never played, but, this was close enough. And then the third act is this kind of breakdown. It's like, a flash forward of what happens after that first act where the one guy gives up on the game and leaves, and you find out about all the aftermath and the stuff that went down, and it's kind of this almost academic interrogation of what games mean and living in the moment. And so as a piece, it's pretty exciting.
Sounds like they should bring that to New York post-haste. I will just briefly note, as we mentioned, Fun Home, Hamilton. These are ones we don't need to mention.
Which I will say I named Fun Home, I think, is my favorite last year because it premiered.
Yeah, that's true. It did technically premiere. Although I will say that I was not totally sold on it until it moved to Broadway. I think it landed somewhere special with this in the round staging, and they just slightly tweaked it enough that it really, really brought it home. In any case, and there's, you know, I think The Humans is and John by Annie Baker. Stephen Karam's The Humans and John by Annie Baker felt like really extraordinary new American plays. And they got a really big, lavish productions, and The Humans is going to Broadway. I don't know when Annie Baker's going to go to Broadway, but maybe.
I don't know if she wants to go to Broadway.
She says she doesn't want to go to Broadway.
No, but I mean, you know, eventually she'll write a play that might go there. Anyway, the flick had a commercial run. It's still running, right?
Yeah, it's still running.
Until January.
It has a new cast now. But.
So I will just highlight two extraordinary revivals of works that I, let's see, Cloud Nine was one, Carol Churchill at the Atlantic. It's a seminal play that I saw in a staging maybe 10, 12 years ago in L.A. Didn't quite land for me. It was clearly a play that had influenced people like Tony Kushner and many others after, and Paula Vogel, other folks who came after this play, with its the first act being set in colonial Africa, I believe, and then the second, you know, British colonial Africa, and the second act set in contemporary London, which was contemporary in the 70s, in which the genders and races a little less, but genders and relationships get mixed up between the two acts. Hard to explain this play, but it's beautiful, and it was beautifully cast and directed by James McDonald, who's a Carol Churchill specialist. I would single out Brooke Bloom in particular, her performance. I could watch her do anything. She's amazing. And there were some hard benches in the theater, which people seem to complain about, but I did not mind that as much as I did, speaking of Annie Baker, her Vanya was very uncomfortable seating, but I will say one thing about it was very warm in the theater, but anyway, that's an old person thing to say.
It's very warm now.
It is warm now. The other one is The Color Purple, which I actually was among the few who really enjoyed the original production 10 years ago that Gary Griffin directed. It was a little bit maybe overproduced and busy, and I think it maybe obscured the sort of heart of the show. The new production that's on Broadway now, I think, is favored to get the revival Tony over Spring Awakening. And it's a beautiful, rousing. I've seldom felt as much connection between the audience and the people on stage as I did at that.
Well, you and I were at the same production.
Yeah, the same performance.
It was insane.
I think it's probably that way every night. I mean, you know, Something Rotten gets a standing ovation after that number of the musical just because it's fun. But Cynthia Erivo gets a standing ovation, I'm sure, probably every night after her big ultimate climactic number of empowerment. It's really, and it's a very savvy performance too, because it's a very passive role that needs to bloom slowly, and she just handles it beautifully. So that's I would recommend that as the Broadway show to see, if you can't get tickets to Hamilton. I guess Susie would say King and I, but I would say Color Purple.
No, I would agree with Rob. Get tickets to Color Purple too. See two shows.
See two shows. Two musicals. Two musicals. All right. So that was the year that was. We pretty much covered it all, right? I don't think there's any. A Futurity I would have put on my list too.
And we all liked Hamilton, but we you knew that. Hamilton.
Surprise.
Yeah. I'm waiting for someone to write a brilliant takedown of it because it hasn't happened yet. Let's see. This week we interviewed Mary Zimmerman, as I said. I spoke to the director, adapter, famous for such productions as Metamorphoses and The White Snake and Journey to the West. She's taken a slight turn where she's directing. Well, she directed Guys and Dolls, didn't do anything special with it, just did the musical at Organ Shakes. It's now playing in L.A. at the Wallace. It's actually really a lovely and very entertaining production. It brings out the qualities of the book in a way that you always hear what a great book it is, but it's an amazing book. And the score is gorgeous, too. And she's got a production of Treasure Island, which is more in the vein of what she does with the longtime company she's worked with, Looking Glass in Chicago, where she takes a prose work and adapts it for the stage. So I had a great time talking to her, and I hope you have a great time listening. We'll come back right after.
Where are you staying while you're there?
An Airbnb in Los Angeles.
Oh, nice.
Just outside Beverly Hills.
I'm speaking to you from New York, and you're in L.A., and I think that's the first time I met you, even though you're from Chicago.
Seriously? Once. In L.A.?
when you brought Arabian Nights to the Actors Gang, yes. We had a memorable lunch at, I think it was called Swingers, that club on 3rd Street or Beverly.
Which I think is still there. I think I passed it the other day, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that was where the infamous the story you told me about how someone shouted out the window, "Nice hair." Do you remember
this?
Yes, I revisit this as an icebreaker every time I talk to you, Mary.
No, it wasn't nice hair. They shouted out, "Your hair sucks."
Oh my God, really?
That's what it was.
I thought it was nice hair, like sarcastic, but this
no, it was much more direct. Your hair sucks.
Wow, that's a great place to start. So,
that's my impression of LA. Yeah,
that's your impression of LA. I mean, obviously, you're there. Did you have to do any, you know, restaging or work for the Wallace with Guys and Dolls?
Not really. It slipped right in. I had to do that thing. You know, they've been running it almost 10 months. And if they're 1 degree off course 10 months ago, they're quite far from what it should be, you know, right. Like an ocean liner having drifted off course. So there was a little bit of that wrestling back.
Right.
And like, there's a laugh we were never getting in one thing, you know, little things like that. But okay. It actually physically slipped right in, and they've been running it forever. So it was, you know, we're not rehearsing today. Some of our rehearsals were 90 minutes long. So
I know you've taken shows all over the place, and they've had long lives at various theaters. But would this be fair to say this is like the longest run you've supervised? Or Metamorphoses had a longer run on Broadway, right? Or no?
Yeah, it did have a longer run on Broadway, and it had almost as long a run, believe it or not, in Chicago, the really? Original run. Yeah, because we were in a theater that we rented, and it didn't have any other rentals. And, you know, we built that show to run 6 weeks, and I think it ran 8 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think almost destroyed the theater that it was in. there was wheat growing under the stage when we ripped it up because we had some little stalks of wheat in, you know, a sort of hat, and the little seeds had fallen in. And
wow.
It was a not good environment. We didn't know we were building a pool of water, you know, for 8 months.
Right. And so when I get the water probably seeped in and helped to water the wheat.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Life forms.
Yeah. Now, we've talked a little bit before when I did a long interview with you for my Bill Rausch piece, and I only used a little bit of it, you might have seen, yeah. but because it was all about Bill and OSF. But we talked a bit about the slightly new direction you're taking as a director, right?
It's a new direction, but I don't think of it as a permanent new direction. It's just, okay. You know, it's just something I'm doing. I've always just sort of followed my nose and done what I was attracted to doing in the moment, you know.
Right. Now, we're sort of American musical theater. Was that canon something that was never attractive to you at one point? At some point you thought, oh, I like this actually.
I would never say it was never attractive to me. Never, not at all. I just had other things that were more attractive that were pressing on me. And I didn't think of myself, you know, I can't sing myself.
Right.
And so I didn't do musicals as a kid. I did plays as a kid.
Right.
And that's just sort of the path I was on, you right. know?
And well, then I think the other thing is not just the musical part of it, but the script part of it. I mean, we talked about this, and maybe this is overemphasized, but it is the signature of your work that you walk in with most of your other work with nothing on a page, right?
That's correct.
Right, yeah. And this is quite, like the opposite. I know with Candide was somewhere in between because you took a script and adapted it, right?
Right, well, I actually did not look at the other scripts. I tried to not look at them. I just looked at the Voltaire novel. I mean, it was unavoidable to know that this song belongs to a scene, obviously, around that, you know, whatever. But I did not study the scripts. I kind of glanced and put them down. I didn't want to imitate them or I got permission for all of them. And
yeah,
so
sure.
Forever it has all of those credits on it.
Yeah.
I didn't actually look at them because I wanted to be safe in case I accidentally exactly replicated something, you know.
Sure.
Also, by the way, just the entire conception of making a musical out of that and deciding where there should be songs, like that's a huge credit that should always remain to the original people who did it.
Of course.
So that's why all those names are on it.
But so essentially that was a literary adaptation that happened to have a score.
Yes.
You could slide into it. So it was in a sense sort of, we call it a hybrid work because most of your stuff doesn't have a score.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Or has a history.
Right, it has a new score, but doesn't have a score, yeah.
Exactly. Right. So tell me about what surprised you, what you learned in doing, would Guys and Dolls be fair to say your first canonical American musical apart from Candide, which is a
Yes, and my first non-problematic American musical, you know what I mean? Like, Candide, in a way, was up my alley because it was a kind of complicated, contexted text that had defeated a lot of the great minds of American arts and letters for 50 years. And that's actually more typical. I tend to do things that are a little bit more problematic or unloved as text or more obscure or not at all dramatic text to begin with, primarily. But yes, Guys and Dolls... I'll tell you, one of the reasons I wanted to do it was just for a change. I wanted to work in the theater, starting with something that I was confident had a reasonable chance of pleasing its audience. Everything I do is a bit of a shot in the dark. Like, I have enormous faith in it, and I'm pretty sure it's going to please me, but it doesn't have a history of performance.
Right.
And not of contemporary theatrical performance. Most of what I've adapted actually is performative. They were oral tales to begin with. And so I think they want to return to the air. I've always felt that they are dramatic texts, but not in the conventional modern sense that we think of that word meaning. So I just wanted to be around something that was going to be joyful to do and that was going to teach me something about, I mean, it's a kind of virtuosic piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
And that's something it does have in common with the texts that I choose, is I think that they're masterpieces of their genre, and definitely Guys and Dolls falls into that. And I did, I wanted to learn, like, how do you make an evening like this? And also, I think I'm in a sort of unique position in thinking about Guys and Dolls as an act of adaptation, which it is. It's from a literary source, the Damon Runyon story.
Oh, right.
And I really see, because it's not normally talked about in this way, what a brilliant adaptation it is. Hmm. how it takes this vast body of really sort of rambling, disparate stories where characters float from one to the other story, a kind of world, and compresses it into this 2 hours really tightly knit plot in which every part of the plot hangs on every other part of the plot. It all hangs on finding a location for that game, which leads to the bet, which leads to the romantic story, which doubles back to it's the mission that ends up being the location.
Yeah, yeah.
The game, because he does take the doll to Havana, thus leaving the space empty for the game. It all hangs on itself in a really masterful way. So I wanted to be, like when I do a Shakespeare play, I always just want to, you know, live in that world and be as close to that world as I can, and hopefully just absorb some of the skill and the craftiness that is in those plays.
You know? Yeah, that's right. I forgot. There's also your Shakespeare you've done, but also opera.
Yeah,
which definitely has text walking into it.
Yes.
Lots of text, lots of music.
I mean, the music is a big, grand bully in the room, and we all bow down. You know,
yeah. Yeah.
So it's a different kettle of fish as well.
So tell me, was directing this? Did you feel like you had to not relearn what you do, but did it feel completely different than what you usually do? Were you
not at all? Because honestly, I'm always trying to lean into the story. That's a big cliche of directors to say. I know it's a big trope, but I'm attracted to the text, I'm attracted to the story, I'm attracted to the thing that it is, and I'm just trying to do it. And you know, it's interesting, Rob, so many people have said on hearing us do this, I can't wait to see what you're doing with it. And I really say, I'm just trying to do the guysiest and dollsiest guys and dolls I could. Like, I'm actually don't have a deconstructive impulse in my work. It's
right.
The stuff I do wasn't written for the theater, so I, by necessity, it contains all these possible to stage things. So I have to make these big directors and designers and visual moves in order to create the illusion that we're seeing someone turn into an animal or melt into a river or a train of camels or fly on a carpet or all of that stuff. I have to find solutions for that. But, you know, Guys and Dolls was eminently written for the theater and is accomplishable as it is. And I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm sure that it's inflected through my own voice. Everything people do in theater, you know, it's inflected through us. But I don't have a deconstructive impulse towards it or the desire to, like, make big moves on it. My desire is to do it really well. And I also have the feeling when I'm working that I'm just trying to get out of the way. Just trying to get out of the way and let this thing come through me. And that's true of sort of everything I've ever done. The feeling is it's coming through and I'm trying to get out of the way.
So it's like a perfect musical. It's a great piece of entertainment.
Yeah.
You don't have to write anything. What was it just a lot easier for you? Or I guess what was the thing you struggled with the most on this one? I guess I would ask.
You know, it has a lot of some sort of corny lines, which I kind of expected the actors to challenge me on. Like, do I really have to make this joke that's so old-fashioned? And none of them ever did. They embraced it fully. And I think that might be because I'm working with Oregon Shakespeare Festival actors who are used to classic texts and old texts, and they just have a high value on the text.
Right.
You know, there's certain scenes that the tone, finding the right, how to find the laugh that you know is there, but it's a little tricky.
Yeah.
That was the toughest part, I think.
Go on, sorry.
The plot is so clear. The story makes sense. The characters are so clear. So that's not something you're figuring out. It's not illogical ever, you know?
This is one thing that I can't remember who pointed out to me. I have to credit someone else, whoever you are, you probably know if you're listening, who pointed out that Kate Hurster, I mean, I thought she was great, but she's one of the first Sarahs who's funny. That I've ever
pointed
seen.
It out.
Okay, that was you. All right. Well, I credit you, Mary.
We have some just a slew of, I think, brilliant and perfect performances in this that are a new. You know, there's a lot of people who can do Guys and Dolls really beautifully. A lot of guys are built for it. You know, to play those old gangsters and stuff, or gamblers. You know, they just have it in them.
Yeah.
But an awful lot of the time, the Sarah is a little. Sometimes she's a little dull, and she's cast for her beautiful soprano voice and maybe her beautiful looks, and they sort of forget about the part that she's in charge of, the kind of big number, big climax of the first act, which is the Havana scene when she's drunk.
Yeah.
And they're not very funny at it. They're not very funny drunks. And the way Kate does If I Were Belle is so fresh and so hilarious. I mean, she's really, really drunk. And she's just – and yet she also sings it really beautifully. Yeah, she's just amazing in that scene, I think.
In this case,
our little ace in the hole, our little secret, I feel like, that you don't expect.
It's one case where –
Skye to be great. You expect Skye to be – you know, you expect all that. But
yeah, sure.
But often isn't that great.
I mean, it's this one advantage of having – we spoke about this also. You may not have Broadway singers at Oregon Shakes, but you've got great actors and you know, great farcical performers who could, you know – and I've seen Kate do a lot of work like that.
You've got some pretty strong voices in there, really, seriously.
Right. You do. And also to see Robin, who I'd seen for many years.
Yes.
She always seemed to be sort of waiting for her musical theater close-up, basically, you know? And she did great work in every other kind of show, really.
Yeah, she lobbied for the part. She really, really wanted it. She wanted to do Adelaide. I'm very happy to have her.
She's great in it.
Yeah.
So switching gears to Treasure Island.
Yes.
This is a return to the classic Mary Zimmerman, right? The classic Looking Glass?
Except that it's from A Modern Consciousness. It's from a single author. It's a literary rather than originally an oral text. Most of what I've done is originally oral that kind of coalesces into a received literary form, but pre-existed that myth or fairy tales, you know, from all over the world. And this is from a modern, for me, almost contemporary 19th century consciousness. So in that way, it's different, but it does share the kind of epic sweep of things I like. Nothing impossible happens in it, however. It's a fantastic adventure, but again, there's no need to – I mean, there's definitely staging solutions that have to be found, but there aren't any sea monsters is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, darn. You're dashing the hopes of many children with that one. No, it sounds like that's the kind of adaptation that Looking Glass – other artists in Looking Glass, Laura Eason has done, and other folks have done 19th century novels. But I never thought about, as you point out, that yours were myths or oral texts originally.
Yes, so, and often exist in multiple forms. Like there's multiple versions of the story.
Right.
Even multiple literary texts of the stories.
So now you'd said this felt like it needed to return to the air.
Yeah.
Would you say Treasure Island is, it was harder to get into the air? Or?
It is a little bit. You're absolutely right, because it was a literary work. And, you know, here's the, so this was an interesting thing about it. It was written originally serially in installments. And so it has this structure in which every chapter or event is about exactly the same length and has a kind of event or suspenseful thing happens at the end. And it does that for something like 26 chapters. And that is not the form of theater. Do you know what I mean? So sort of working my way around that structure to find a more suitable rise of action and climb, you know, all of that. That was the tricky part on this. Structurally, it was just a little bit tricky. And then staging-wise, the most difficult is this three-chapter section where Jim so heroically goes out at night in a tiny little boat, and he sort of captures the ship back, and he sees two pirates sort of killing each other. And it's all first-person narration. It's all internal. There's no conversation. And that I saved to the very end. We were already on stage. I'd written everything else, but we were missing this chunk of that central adventure.
Right.
And then I had the thought, which is the same thought I've had, but I still didn't have it for a while with this. Oh, I'll put it into third person. I'll make it a sort of sea shanty about this adventure sung by the woman who plays his mother so that it describes from the outside. And we, you know, compress those three chapters into, it's about 4 minutes. And I'm proud of it. And it's something I've done before, but it still took me a while to sort of figure out, oh, step out of the first person that this book is in and step above it and narrate it. But it's a device I've used a lot in Metamorphoses, in the Eros and Psyche section. It's illustrated, but it's a conversation between two people talking about what happened. And in a way, this is that same move. It's to take it from another point of view.
Right.
And that helps you compress and get to the heart of it.
Well, so you don't have to stage all that stuff, right?
No, I mean, I do stage it.
You do stage it, okay.
But it's staged you're right. You stage selectively. You stage moments of it, and it's being sung, so it's musical, and there's movement, and it's lots of image and like that. It switches its modality of telling for that section, you know.
Right. So it doesn't have to be all shown. So it's from
exactly point to point. But, that's a big, you know. Novels are much much longer than play evenings.
Right.
If you show absolutely everything, you know, or have to put in everything into the dramatic mode, into conversation, if you cut narrative, you're just sunk. In terms of my work, I sort of feel like I rely on those moments of narrative to carry us very far, very fast.
Right.
At the same time, I try to keep it to a minimum narrative, you know, by which I mean the narrator speaking directly to the audience. And this book does that. It's in first person. You want it either to be serving a really efficient function or to be so beautifully written and spoken that you can't not do it.
Right.
That's always the rule for me. I try to eliminate it as much as possible, but keep those sections.
I'm intrigued by, not to change subject, but, you know, Robert Falls and Seth Beauclair working on that Roberto Bolaño novel that's going to be like 5 hours or something, or I forget. I don't know what they're going to cut. Maybe you should give them some pointers on how to.
I don't give anyone any pointers because I don't know the book, but I know it's very excited about. I heard there was a read through that was very exciting. So
yes,
you know, Bob is very fearless. I mean, he's just great that way. He's very bold and fearless in his approach to all his projects, I think.
Yeah, I don't know the book, but my wife's a fan. And when I told her they're doing that book, she said, "What? How do you stage that book?" You know, but I guess that's a question you want to ask.
Out.
The last thing I want to ask you about, Mary, is Doug Peck mentioned this. Wonderful Town is coming up next summer. Is that at the Goodman, right?
Yes, but it's been pushed back to the fall, actually.
They had
an opportunity to do something very exciting, and I hadn't really started work, so we pushed it back. So, yes.
There's not much to say about it, I guess. Just yay, Wonderful Town.
Yay, Wonderful Town, and that it's not on the town. That's my big concern.
No sailors.
Even Rock Schoelfer made the same mistake. We were down the road, and Rock was still under the illusion we were doing on the town.
Now, that would be fun to do. I've never seen Wonderful Town. I know the score. It's been done here a couple times. Is that a problem show? Is it like, it's not done because the book is weird?
You know, honestly, I feel like I'm in my home territory because, yes, it's quirky and a little problematic, and it's not the famous one. And that's what I like. I like getting in there. Although, I'll say right now, I have no plan, and I haven't asked for permission to do anything to the book. I may eventually ask or something, but that's not how I'm approaching it. I'm approaching it as a very interesting, quirky, like a lot of Bernstein, a very quirky, interesting, with some fantastic things in it, and like just trying to find a way to bring it to the best life it can. I like the problematic Shakespeare plays. I've done even in opera some of the more problematic. I like the problematic text, which is why Guys and Dolls in that way is such an anomaly.
Such a departure.
If there's any problem, it's with us or with me. It's not going to be with the material.
With the material. Yeah, no, there's no problem with you either. It's a great production.
Well, thank you very much.
Mary, I wish you, I don't know if you say break a leg to the director, but I wish, the show is up now, right, or no?
Yeah, well, we're in previews. You know, our first preview was our 120th performance of the show. Wow. So, you know, they're very confident and all that. But thank you, Rob. You're always so nice to talk to. Thank you. Always a
pleasure, Mary.
Thanks. Okay.
Take care.
I hope I can figure out how to hang out. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye now.
So we're back, and we usually do this at this portion of the show. We usually do recommendations, but we kind of did that with our look back at highlights. Instead, we're going to look forward to 2016, not with resolutions, but with wishes, hopes, things we're looking forward to. Again, I'll start with you, Susie.
Oh, man, that's a lot of pressure. Well, the first part of the prompt was to do a wish for anything theatrical. And this is a big wish. But you know what? I don't think it's unreachable because there was an article, I believe it was when Stephen Colbert took over The Late Show from David Letterman. And Stephen Colbert loves theater. He did the production company at Lincoln Center. And, you know, he didn't know what he was going to do after the Colbert Report. And he's pals with Jon Stewart, who also retired. And, you know, didn't know what he was going to do after The Daily Show. He still, I don't think, has a full-time gig since he left The Daily Show. Anyway, they both are big fans of theater, and so there was a line, I believe, in this New York Times profile where Stephen Colbert said that he and Jon Stewart were thinking about doing a production of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead together.
Wow.
And I really want that to happen. So even if it's a one-night benefit reading, you know, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern
Are
Dead. I'm
so glad you didn't say The Odd Couple, but go on.
No, because they literally had a phone call where they talked about it.
Gatto, they could do any of those. But
yeah. Just shut up and take my money, guys.
Well, okay, so they could do Gatto, they could do The Odd Couple, but I would really love to see them in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern
awesome.
Are Dead.
That's awesome.
That's my wish.
Cool.
That's
Allison?
That's a good wish. All right, so my wish is for 2016. This goes back to our November issue of Access and Ability. And I spoke a lot with a lot of theaters who are casting actors with disabilities. And so I'm just hoping that that's something that continues through 2016. We saw it with Spring Awakening this year, and I spoke to Allie Stroker, and the Casting Society of America now has town halls that they've been in meeting with and committees monthly about how to be more inclusive with casting. So I just hope that it's a topic that keeps rolling in through the new year.
Great.
Yes. On a similar theme of inclusivity, we all know that this season on Broadway is supposed to be the most diverse ever assembled. And with like the first, you know, musical writ entirely created by Asian Americans, the first play entirely created by women, and Fun Home just won all the awards. So that's the first musical created by women. And I would like to see that momentum continue, not just on Broadway, but also in other theaters. Because, as I've said many times, having one black playwright in your season of all white playwrights does not make you diverse.
Right. Hooray for that. Russ?
Actually, continuing in that vein, I just like to see more and more representation of people from marginalized groups, from underrepresented groups, just in general, more variety, because it's not only just a human rights thing, but like variety is an awesome thing.
Aesthetically, right.
Aesthetically, yeah, right. Yeah, so there are so many wonderful stories out there from different cultures, from people with different abilities, from people of different genders that we just haven't heard. And I think it would be great to bring those to the stages of our country.
Right. Here.
It is something where I think theater can take a leadership role in that. And it has in some cases. When you look at a lot of other sectors of society, which, again, as I've written this before, it's not an excuse to say, look, they're just as bad or they're worse or whatever in Hollywood or Washington. But I do think theater, in some metrics, is doing the right thing in some places and needs to take up that leadership role. I mean, it's something where theater can, again, be a leader in the conversation as it was, you know, in the past.
Right. Yes. Because most of theater is not commercial. And so when you're not going to make money off of what you're programming anyway. So why not be a little bit more adventurous and not just program what you think will be pleasing to your subscribers?
I mean, I would say counterintuitively that probably it's also good business to be diverse too. It's not just throwing caution to the wind and going, oh, let's. But it's true. If you're going to take artistic risks, take risks in that direction. Why not, if you're going to do a crazy new play, why not do a crazy new play that represents voices that haven't been on your stage before? So I will say my wish is, it's not necessarily related, but I recently had the great privilege to interview Eric Bentley, one of my critical idols. He's 99 years old. He translated Brecht and, you know, just the list of people that he wrote about, saw, worked with, knew. And is considered in his long publishing career as a critic and writer is stunning. I've been observing with everyone else the way criticism, theater criticism and arts journalism has been on the ropes for a long time. Lots of folks who have been at the Post, their posts for a long time have, including The Post, have either been let go or made freelance or they're
bought out
or their inches have shrunk. That sounds terrible. Their column inches have shrunk. The space and breadth of theater criticism out there. When you go from Eric Bentley to reading a couple hundred review, even a well written one, it feels like there are people, and I include the people in this room, but there are people out there who know a lot of theater, have seen a lot of theater, have a lot of thoughts about theater. And I, this is my wish, and it's something I think we can, at American Theater, can be a part of realizing, is to publish those writers and hire writers to give larger insights and context into the theater we're seeing, including all the exciting new theater we're seeing, but also linking it to the past, linking it to past. I feel like that's what Eric Bentley was doing 50 years ago. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of great critics since and good books published since, but I would love to see someone, and I know the people are out there and in here, to help make sense of this, of theater history, theater present, and the theater future. So I, that's an ambitious goal, but I think we can publish more, basically publish these folks at American Theater.
So are you asking them to pitch you?
Pitch me. No, I mean, that's part of it. I think I'm also going to be looking for ways to support new arts journalists and also tap the arts journalism and the brains and the thoughts and insights that are there and not being published elsewhere. That's what I guess.
But I also think he's wishing for other organizations to
follow his lead. I would love to. I think I'm hoping that we can be a leader and that it's a positive trend that we can be at the forefront of. And I hope that we can turn the tide to some extent, of the shrinking arts coverage. And, you know, which is not just about covering great things, but about,
Contextualizing them.
Yeah. Making it a thoughtful exchange. And also, again, for me, making it part of the long, you know, march of theater history, which I think we're all part of. It wasn't just, created, you know, last season. So anyway,
no one else is dreamcasting anything? These are all like high and lofty, beautiful, good people goals. Who's your celebrity crush?
You know, I was joking. I said the Q brothers should you know, be in Hamilton at some point. But
ladies should be Hamilton. Ladies should be founding fathers.
Yeah, that's a whole other show.
That's a different show.
But I think it's been an exciting 2015, and we look forward to an exciting 2016. Please stay tuned. You can see links to all the things we talked about on the post page here. Please rank us on iTunes. Review us. Helps other people like you find us. And see you in the new year.